All right, there
welcome
you go.
to the Hawk Show. This is Matt Hawking alongside Dan Konderman, as always, and we're joined by a very special guest today, one of the pioneers of computer gaming, Al Lowe. Welcome to the show, Al.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, yeah, you contributed to the delinquency of millions of people around the world with the Leisure Suit Larry series.
Hey, myself, we all have our part to play, man.
But, yeah, actually, that was one of the first big adventure series for Sierra alongside King's Quest. Though, actually, you developed one of my favorite adventure games from back when I was a kid, which is Black Cauldron.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, that is a title from the far distant past. I believe that I worked on that in 1984.
I think that was the very first computer game I ever owned.
Really? Well, it's one of my favorites still. I was very proud of the fact that I almost invented point-and-click adventure games with that game. The problem was that nobody had a mouse, so they couldn't really point and click. So I ended up substituting different function keys on the keyboard for the various icons that came into use later on. But it was funny, the names for the variables and everything that I used, the flags that I used in the source code, became the set of icons that we used in all the games from, I don't know, King's Quest 4 on, whenever we went to the point and click interface. So, yep, we had a do it and a talk it and a take it and drop it and all those different functions, and those were all came about in that game. That's a rare game. Very few people know that one.
Yeah, actually, to tell you the truth, I did not see the movie until 5 years ago. So the only
experience it wasn't released. You couldn't see it. It was one of those that were locked in the Disney vaults. So on one hand, I think in that case it was probably well that they kept it locked up, because it wasn't that great a movie. But it was very exciting for me, because I was, until recently, a school teacher, and to be able to fly down to the Disney studios and receive a tour of the innermost archives of the Disney history, and to I got the original score that was written by Elmer Bernstein. I had original background art from the Disney watercolors, and we had cells of animation from the original film. I mean, it was, in fact, there. I have a wonderful story if you want to hear it sometime about that incident. When I went to the archives, there was one woman who worked there, she said she was really dreading next week because. All of the cells from the Black Cauldron were coming in. And I said, oh, you have to file everything and archive them, put them away? And she said, no, I have to go through and throw away 99% of it and figure out which is the 1% that we save. At that time, they discarded all the cells.
Oh, wow.
And I was just amazed that nobody – of course, that was the last pre-Eisner movie. Once Eisner came in, they realized a profit center when one was staring them in the face. And you look at the business that's grown into.
But I think that's really interesting. How did you get involved in the computer game industry if you were a school teacher before that? Was it just a hobby?
Well, I was a jazz musician, a professional musician all my life, and starting at age 13. And I went to college to be as a music major and realized that you can't make a living doing that. So I turned into music education, became a school teacher, and then became a school music administrator. So what better course of preparation could one have than to be a game designer with that? How did it happen? I got interested in computers early on because I used to chart halftime shows, and I thought that moving little people around on a football field was kind of similar to moving dots around on a computer screen, and that somebody should write a program to do that. I was told by our school district's IT department that that would be about the last thing they ever programmed. So they said, but you can have this book on BASIC, and you can learn to do it yourself. So on the way to doing that, I ended up realizing that it was a lot more fun to play games, and ended up writing games just from first for my son's amusement, and later to sell educational properties. And then when those were successful, Sierra picked them up, and I became the majority of Sierra's educational product line. And from that, I slid over across from the education area into the regular games, and from that into the 3D adventure games, and I guess the rest people know.
The perfect transition from Black Cauldron, a Disney product, to Leisure Suit Larry.
You know, it's funny. It is causal, though. There's a causal relationship there, because one of the most successful computer games of history was Softporn.
Yeah.
And it was the only text-only game that Sierra ever published. But it was a huge hit at a time when Apple had sold 100,000 computers. Sierra had sold 25,000 copies of that game. And everyone I knew had a pirated version. So I figured it probably had just about 100% market penetration.
Wow.
Yep. So Softporn was actually the first game written about in Time magazine. When Time started their computer column, the very first issue they ever had discussed Softporn and how it, you know, was a big success and stuff. So when Disney came along, when we got the rights to the Disney characters, Disney said, you know, we can't really have our Mickey Mouse in the same catalog as Softporn. Well, by that time, the game had, you know, had run its course and was old, and so they dropped it from the line. Well, then we kept the Disney rights for a long time, but found out that when you do a game for Disney, Disney ends up making the money, and you get the honor of working for Disney. So we decided, and at that time, you know, licensed products were more of a handicap than a help. Licensed games were looked down upon. So the stuff that we did, you know, Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck's Playground, I wrote a game called Donald Duck's Playground, and Winnie the Pooh and the 100-Acre Wood, and all those products didn't really sell any better, and sometimes worse, than the ones that were just, you know, created by our own staff and where we kept all the money. So we let the rights to the Disney characters go, and that must have been about 1986 or so. But so we were casting about for something, a new project for me, and Ken Williams and I were discussing. He said, well, what about if we did a 3D version of Softporn? You know, bring that up to date with our new AGI interpreter, which, of course, is pretty out of date nowadays, but at the time was cutting edge. So I said, well, let me go. You know, I don't remember the game that well. I played it, but I didn't finish it. Let me go home and try it, and I'll see. And I came back and reported to him. I said, oh, man, this game's so out of date, it should be wearing a leisure suit. And I got a laugh, just like that. and I said, you know, the only way I could actually do a version of this game would be is if you'd let me make fun of it. If I did it as a joke, then I think we could probably do something. So I kept the puzzles from Softporn, and those were the basis of Leisure Suit Larry 1. And I threw out all the text and all the characters and rewrote everything. And actually, there were very few characters in the original game. And the weirdest part was that there was no central character. There was no protagonist. The game spoke to you as if you were the player. So it said, you do this and you do that. And you, it had lines like, I am your puppet master. I will do what you bid. You know, things, it was bad. Anyway, I mean, it was written by a guy who was a database programmer. You know, Chuck Benton was trying to figure out whether he could use an Apple II to run database apps for, you know, his local business. And so he thought, well, what can I use as a test bed for that? And so he wrote an adventure game, literally to see if he could do database access on a on an Apple II, and ended up, you know, making a ton of money and selling a lot of games. But so that's how the connection came from. Because soft porn was thrown out by Disney, and then when Disney left, we brought soft porn back, but because it was out of date, I made fun of it, and therefore it became a humorous product that was built on a slight foundation of a great hit. So, there you go.
And then, of course, you ended up making 6 of them.
Well, at least. It depends on how you count, but we did 6 adventure games in the series. We didn't number them that way, of course, but we also did a product called the Laffer Utilities, which was years ahead of its time, and I think had we marketed it several years later, it would have been much more successful than it was. It was a collection of little utility products that. Not unlike the Norton utilities were back then, command line driven things that you could access from DOS, about 18 or 20 different little titles, and they would do interesting things like decide where do you want to go for lunch today, and a joke database for salesmen, and let's see, horoscopes that were just silly, funny, outrageous kind of things. Stuff like that. So at the time, I mean, it sold several hundred thousand copies, but I think it would have hit much bigger had it been in the Windows era when things were more easily accessible.
To tell you the truth, I think I actually have a copy of that somewhere because I did go out when they had the box sets.
Uh-huh.
You know, they came out with the 6 CD box sets or whatever. I think it was in there.
That's right. You're right. It was. We actually made a Windows version of it later on that did sell pretty well. And I believe they put that in that complete collection. That's not to be confused with the current collection that's being sold.
Yeah. I like the old one better.
Well, the old one is complete. And and the new one is not. Regrettably,
the only thing good about the new one is that it runs on XP, of course. But.
Yeah, I guess. I don't think they did anything to make it run on XP.
They packaged it with some kind of software then. Because I have.
It's there's a shareware program called DOSBox. That is universally used these days to access the old DOS programs. And so they threw a copy of that shareware program on the disks with the games to make it easier for people to run them. But I have tips like that on my website. Oh, I should plug my website, allo.com.
There you go.
Yeah. And there are tips on there about how to make the games run and how to see these pieces of software archaeology here. Artifacts of an earlier era.
But, the thing about the sequels, though, is that nowadays people really complain about, well, you know, there's too many. But nobody ever did back then. Like, I bought all 8 King's Quests. You know, I was excited.
We didn't make them because they didn't sell.
Yeah.
You know, had people not bought them, we wouldn't have kept making them. In fact, there's a story. That's, you know, in a funny way, that's a good segue into the thing I mentioned earlier about the numbering of my games. Mm-hmm. When I wrote the first Larry game, it seemed like it was a terrible selling product, and so we didn't think about doing a sequel. I went off and did Police Quest 1 and some other title, and then suddenly Larry was, not suddenly, but gradually, Larry, sales increased, until over a year later, it was on the soft sell hot list with a bullet after a year of being on the marketplace. But then it seemed logical to do a sequel. So I started the sequel, and we did a third one, and I thought, well, you know, trilogies are the thing. There's never more than 3 of a set. So at the end of 3, I tied everything up in the storyline, tied everything up and put a big bow on it and said, well, it's the end of that. I'll go do something new. And what I ended up doing was trying to reinvent the internet because we were too stupid to know that it existed. And we tried to build an online gaming world.
Oh, I remember that.
Yeah, called the Sierra Network, which was...
Because I was subscribed to the Sierra magazine at the time.
Well, you know, that's another wonderful story that I can tell you about. But the Sierra Network was going to be the next thing in gaming. We were going to do online adventure games. Well, we were... Yeah, at 1,200 baud. Yeah, that would be it. That's a good idea. So we figured out at first, we'll walk before we run. So I wrote a backgammon game and checkers and chess and some online games. We set up meeting rooms where you could, as far as I know, the first use of that term, meeting rooms and set to set up games. We invented online avatars to give you a image of yourself that you could change online and dress the way you wanted to and stuff. I mean, things that are pretty commonly accepted now as part of, you know, online gaming. We invented all that stuff that one year there. Well, I shouldn't say quickly because I was pretty slow. I slowly came to the realization that this was going to take way longer to get successful than I could afford to wait. At the time, I wasn't a salaried employee of Sierra. In fact, I worked there for less than a year before I was fired.
Really?
Yeah, in 1982, I think, I signed on as a game designer with them, and then in the spring of, I guess it was spring of 84, maybe something like that, they had a terrible time, and one Friday morning they had 120 employees, and that Friday afternoon they had 40. Now, I was one of the 80 that was let go, but they gave us all the same deal. They said, we're going to pay you in advances against royalties as opposed to paying you salaries, and that way, instead of you being on our books as a big old expense, you'll be on our books as a prepaid asset. And it'll look better to the, you know, taxes and everything else. Oh, okay. So I said, well, what kind of prepaid advances are we talking about? Well, we want you to do that. We want you to do this game. Okay, well, how much is that? Well, okay, this much. And we want you to do that. And I said, well, what about the conversion of this product to the COM64? Oh, yeah, do that. And, well, what's that going to well, by the time we were finished, I was going to make twice as much money as I had made in the past.
Oh, wow.
And so I got up and I said, have I just been fired? And Ken Williams said, yeah. And I said, okay, thanks. And I went home and started to work. And for the next 15 years, that was the relationship I had with Sierra. I was an outside contractor and worked as an outside employee, never was on salary, always worked, always betted on the fruits of my labor. And in some cases, that turned out well. And then other cases, it turned out great, actually. I had a few places where I can't remember. There was a couple times when I lost money. But for the most part, it really worked to my advantage because they would have never paid me the salary that that I earned through royalties because my game sold well. You know, there were a lot of people who had the same deal, and, you know, they produced products that didn't sell. And so, you know, they went on to other fields. So. Yep, so that's that story.
So did you guys ever feel any competition from, let's say, LucasArts, especially when they came out with Monkey Island? Monkey Island was a big hit, and the original Indiana Jones game, too.
You know, it was a different time then. We were all gamers, and we loved new games, and a lot of what we wrote for ourselves and to amuse each other. And so when LucasArts started up and started producing adventure games, we thought, oh, well, this will be great. Let's see what they can do. And when the games were good, it was like, oh, boy, we got new games to play. the market was so wide open back then. It wasn't so much a competitive and cutthroat environment as it is today, because back then we couldn't produce products fast enough to satisfy the customers. Any game that I can remember, Sierra shipped a couple of real dogs. I mean, you know, it happens, right? They shipped a couple of dogs, and they sold. You know, and you think, well, what the hell is the matter with people? Well, it's just people were starving for new games, and they wanted stuff to play, and they would buy, you know, almost anything. So, you know, Outpost comes to mind as a game that, you know, should probably not have been released. Yet, you know, it's
I had
hundreds of thousands. Well, am I wrong? What was your opinion of Outpost?
To tell you the truth, you know, it was kind of like my first Sim City. So I thought it was really cool when I first had it.
Uh-huh.
But now that I've played so many of those kind of games, it wasn't the best one of the genre for sure.
Well, you know, I mean, that's part of that's because it was the, you know, one of the very early ones. You know, I think it came out before Sim City, didn't it? Or maybe at the same time. It might have been right about the same time. But it was in that early learning period of that stuff. But it was so buggy. That's what I was talking about.
Well, yeah.
Was that there were so many bugs. And it wasn't like today when you can issue a patch, have the software check online. Is there a new patch to be downloaded? Oh, yeah, sure, we'll download and install. Hell. If you thought that there was something wrong, you had to write a letter and put a stamp on it and mail it to somebody, and then some person would open that up in Sierra, and they'd go, oh, better get a floppy ready, and they would send a floppy disk through the mail. By that time, you'd forgotten you'd bought the game, you know? So it's it was a different period.
Well, you know, speaking of LucasArts, I bought Loom when it first came out.
Loom is still one of my favorite games of all time.
Really?
I love that game. Well, imagine a former musician, right? You know, what a great theme and what a great game.
So I guess I'm just not musically inclined enough. So when I played it, you know, when I first played it, I thought, oh, this is, you know, really great. It's another adventure game. I like the story, but, you know, I'm playing it today. I just can't do it.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a great game for its time. I mean, I still recall it fondly.
But then, you know, that was kind of actually around the period that the adventure game kind of dipped out of the market. And I think, part of that was Doom. You know, Doom was huge. You know, everybody I knew had a copy of Doom, and it was a first-person shooter. There was no storyline.
Right.
You know, even at the end, you know, you beat the game, and that was pretty much it. You died, and that was the... But, you know, Sierra kind of took that, too. King's Quest VIII... Was that a game that...
Well, yeah, you got to understand that at that point, Roberta read the writing on the wall, and, you know, action games were coming. It's funny. Action games started the computer game business. Arcade games were the big deal when home computers very first started. And when we became able to tell stories through adventure games, we thought, oh, well, that's the way to go. Well, then suddenly people grew tired of that, and the action games came back, and I'm counting Doom among those. Roberta saw that, and she decided to try and meld the two genres together. And, you know, I thought King's Quest VIII was the, you know, bastard offspring of an ill-conceived weekend. Because the way I ended up playing the game was I would go around and kill all the monsters so that I could get to the puzzles in the adventure game. And it was like, I don't want to do this. I don't want to go through all this. I just want to play an adventure game. And, you know, so I think it was neither fish nor fowl and didn't satisfy the people who wanted a story. And, you know, the typical King's Quest kind of cute puzzles and you know, whimsical fantasy. And it didn't satisfy the people who wanted action and killing and hack and slash, you know. So who did it actually please? You know, not many.
And they didn't even have, which I thought was funny, they barely even had any of the characters in the old games. It wasn't even a King's Quest game, really.
No. She tried. You know, I got to hand it to her. She tried to do something new. And,
well, I bought that one too, so I guess.
That was when the company was in real turmoil, too.
Yeah.
That was about the time that Ken and Roberta got bought out, and I think that a lot of the decision-making process was taken away from her when this all happened, and so, you know, people said it's got to be a hack and slash game, and so it's like, well, okay, I'll try, you know, and she did try, you know, she tried her best, but it just was an ill conceived product to start with.
And then of course Sierra got the publishing rights to Half-Life, and that was basically the end of the Sierra.
Yeah, that was the last big Ken Williams acquisition. Homeworld, if you remember that product, and Half-Life were both Ken's final acquisitions, final deals, and that was just right after that he was removed by the criminals who stole the company. I think I can say that legally because they've are in jail. They've been convicted.
Oh, really?
And The SEC fined them $2.5 billion.
Oh, wow.
Which was the largest fine in history of the country until Enron came along. The founders of the company, the main characters, main players at the company that bought Sierra, have gone to jail. Some have plea bargained out. But one's in jail right now. The other is fighting on an appeal. He's fighting on appeal, but it's pretty obvious he's going to lose. So, yeah, it was.
But Half-Life was a big, you know, that was a big deal for them.
It was a big deal because it was a. I thought it was a great game. You know, I thought it was just a well-conceived game, and it, in a way, it was fitting that Sierra did it because it did kind of bring back story.
Yeah.
You know, there's a little bit of story. It's not a big, deep, involved plot, but at least, you know, they try that there is a story there. So, yeah.
So I'm going to ask you a question about, well, now, Vivendi, of course, Vivendi Universal owns Sierra now. But they own them. they own most of the things, but they came out with a Leisure Suit Larry game. Was it 2 years ago? The Magna Cum Laude.
Yeah, and I kept trying to find the joke in that title, and it turned out that there wasn't one. And they changed the lead character to Larry Lovage.
Right.
And I kept trying to find the joke in that character's name, and I failed. I couldn't find one. And then I actually had to go out to the store and buy a copy of the game.
Oh, really?
Because no one there had the even thought to send me a copy. So I did. I went and paid full retail for the product, and I kept trying to find the humor in that product. And I have mixed feelings about it. Some of the things in that game were hilarious. Some of them I would have been really proud to have thought of. But on the whole, the game was just horribly balanced and horribly distorted, I guess, of kind of a funhouse mirror reflection of what the Larry games had been. The games that I did were about humor first and using sex as something to laugh at.
Yeah.
And they thought that the game sold well because they were full of sex. And that's what I was trying to make fun of. So to a certain extent, the writers who were involved on the project early on, they got it. They wrote some funny stuff. And it was kind of bawdy and, you know, and clever, and I thought pretty good. But then the majority of the game was just... Oh, just a nightmare, I thought. So,
I bought it. I played it, of course.
Uh-huh.
I've seen those things like I bought everything. No matter how
well, we appreciate that. You know, that that helps us. Actually, you know, it's funny that you'd say that because people who pirate software are in part responsible for the state of software today, I believe. Because if you like a particular kind of software, and you don't pay for it, that means that you won't see much more of that come around.
Yeah.
And if you do pay for things, then you will get more of that because companies are in business to make money. And the basic rule was if my game sold, then they would give me some more money and I could go play again. You know, it's like if you did it well, then you got a free game and you got to play over. You know, it was that kind of attitude all the time. Well, I think a lot of gamers never realized that by not supporting the games that they liked, they ended up not seeing those games come back again.
Yeah. But, you know, like I said, I bought the, you know, I thought the mini games were, you know, it was a pretty dumb idea. You know, they...
Yeah, but you got to play Borders, didn't you?
Oh, a bunch of times, as a matter of fact.
Endless times. And I evidently, I talked with someone afterwards, and they said that, yeah, I was playing with a mouse and doing something. I don't know, I did something wrong. I didn't understand the premise. And so it took me forever. And then I found out that if you use the arrow keys on the keyboard, it was like, you know, you could do it first time, every time. It was just like the implementation of the interface of the game was not very good. And yeah. So I got to play Quarters even more than most people, I think.
But the funny thing about it was I thought the dialogue was really good.
Yeah, a lot of it was.
They did a song to Summer Lovin' from Greece about being gay. I just thought that was one of the funniest things I had played in a long time.
Yeah,
it was just it was so stupid, but it was hilarious.
Well, and that's, you know, stupid's not bad. But painful.
You don't have to
is.
Tell me.
Yeah, painful is bad, and there were parts of that game that were just painful.
Yeah.
So.
But now we've kind of seen a resurgence.
And I guess we should tell your listeners that I had nothing to do with that product.
I
could probably tell that from the way I speak about it. But,
They kept trying to put you on board, and then they'd forget about you. And
well, different people, it's not that – there is no they there, you know. There's just a whole lot of people. And a lot of people at Sierra then were concerned about the company, and they still cared. And they saw the game and realized it had real problems and tried to do what they could to help it, and several of them thought, well, get Al involved. And I was more than willing to be involved, but they never got to the level of management that needed to make the decision. And so by the time they got down to it, it was more of, well, by Al's, involvement in the project, and don't let him actually do anything. And I was not about to do that. I mean, I may have a price, but it was a hell of a lot more than they offered.
Well, it seemed like they were doing a lot of that, though, at the time, because I remember they were thinking about making a Space Quest shooter, and I think they had gotten in contact with Mark Crow or Scott Murphy.
They called Scott Murphy about that, too. Yeah, that was
it.
I got to understand that they went through a tremendous death spiral at that company. I mean, when Ken and Roberta left, when they got bought out, when they got removed, there were over 1,200 employees, and within I think it was 4 years. No, let me think. 6 years. Within 6 years. They went from 1,200 employees to six, and six locked the doors and turned off the lights and moved to L.A. Into the Vivendi, you know, View Games building. So it was incredibly sad to watch. I started with the company when I was employee number 20, so I was pretty early on. But to watch it go from Ken and Roberta's kitchen table to a billion-dollar market capitalization. That's what the stock was worth when it got taken over. And then back down to nothing, except now it's a logo on a box. You know, they use the word Sierra, but there is no Sierra. There is no Sierra company anymore that I know of. It's a logo on a line. So.
I do want to, in all fairness to Vivendi, I do want to say that I was really thrilled the fact that they, you know, it hasn't come to fruition yet, but they allowed the people behind the King's Quest IX game to use the the characters and the stuff. They couldn't use the words King's Quest.
Yeah, I thought that was odd.
Yeah. But, yeah, I guess, you know, it was nice for them to say, well, all right, you know, if you're going to make this game, go ahead and use the characters.
You know, I mean, there's a difference of philosophy, I think, here, because I've always thought that the stuff that we're not using, we should donate to charity. You know, you should give away. If you've got something and it's still good, don't throw it away. Don't lock it in a closet. Don't stick it in your attic. Give it to somebody who can use it. And I said that about AGI in 1989 when we came out with SCI. In other words, when we had our second generation adventure game technology, that was the difference between the point-and-click games and the old typing games. We had high resolution, we had CD-ROM access, we had better planing of objects, and all these different things that voiceovers and text and windows and all these things that we had added and fixed. I said to Ken, well, let's give away the old game. And he was willing to do so, but the lawyers convinced him that, no, then he'd have to support it. And this was before there was a big, you know, open source movement. And had he just donated the source code to the open source movement, gosh, that would have been so cool. People could have made games and they could have, you know, we didn't use it. So I, you know, later on after Adventure Games died and they didn't use SCI anymore, I thought we should do the same with SCI, that Sierra should just give it away and let somebody have it and have fun with it. But, you know, again, I think the lawyers thought, oh, there might be liability here, and if we do nothing, we won't get sued. But if we do something, we might get sued. And, yeah, it's a sad story, I think, you know. Unfortunately, a lot of people reverse engineered it, and there is an AGI and SCI languages on the web now, and you can access it and build your own games if you want to.
Which, you know, one of the things, though, is, like, for example, Monkey Island, which is my favorite adventure game series. No offense to Leisure Suit Larry, but...
Well, it's one of my favorites as well, I have to assure you.
But, you know, LucasArts says, well, we're going to sit on this game until 2015, and then we'll make another one. But,
that's,
you know, in the meantime, you know, Ron Gilbert, I know, had wanted to finish off the series.
Sure.
Because
I would have loved to finish off Larry. I mean, I could have. I had great plans for the next episode of Larry, and I think it would have been a funny game, and I think it would have sold. But, you know, it didn't happen.
But yeah, and of course, I guess Vivendi knows that they can make money off the Leisure Suit Larry name. Obviously, they.
Oh,
did.
I don't know that they can now.
Well, I guess.
You know, they. I think they kind of. Crapped in their own nest there, to speak, so to speak. They did release a Leisure Suit Larry Love for Sale game in Europe for cell phones.
Oh, yeah, I think I read about that.
Yeah, and I guess, and they actually, I think, surprisingly enough, they used my likeness and Ken and Roberta. And,
oh, really?
Yeah, and I think from what my lawyers say, there's nothing I can do about it. So I guess I have to like it. But because we used, you know, because we made fun of ourselves in the early games, suddenly I became property of Vivendi Games. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah, how about that? Who knew? But they continue to try and sell the products, but I believe that the... the new Larry collection, in spite of its inadequacies, so to speak, has sold very well. I think I've been surprised at the royalty statements I've been receiving.
Oh, wow. I think, Space Quest and King's Quest, too. I haven't heard much about Police Quest. I don't know how popular that really was back in the day, because I never played them. But,
It was probably the equivalent of Space Quest. I don't think it was as big as Leisure Suit Larry, and Larry wasn't as big as King's Quest. I think the pecking order was King's Quest, Larry, Space Quest, and Police Quest were about tied.
Well, see, I guess I was really into the Space Quest thing because that
was. Well,
me
too. I love those two guys. I mean, if you knew Mark and Scott, I mean, they are just like those games. I mean, they're just that funny. They're crazy. They're weird. They're silly. They're they're just funny. Great people.
But
You know, I think that's something that I don't mean to get too melancholy here, but I believe that one of the things that's lost in today's games is the fact that our games reflected our personalities. That if you knew Jim Walls, if you knew Police Quest, you knew Jim Walls. If you knew Space Quest, you knew Mark and Scott. If you knew Larry, you knew me. I mean, we were allowed to inject enough of our personalities into the game. And we were the only people that had any say-so about the products. Ken rarely got in our way. He rarely, he never had a marketing research firm come in and tell us what people thought we should do. He never had people, you know, go out and take outside surveys and go all that stuff. It was like, well, what do you think's funny? Okay, yeah, let's do that. And therefore, you know, if you enjoyed King's Quest, you would enjoy talking with Roberta because that's just the way she is, you know. So yeah. I think that's something that's missing from games today that are done by these, you know, committees of designers and writers and legions of programmers and artists. I think it's very tough to get any sort of personality that way. Just like, you know, a Woody Allen movie is going to be, or a Bergman film or a Scorsese film is going to be different from a James Cameron, you know, kind of film. Although he's got you know, pretty good viewpoint. But I mean, you know, a lot of the commercial, you know, big action films and so forth don't have a lot of soul because they've been run through so many filters. There's so many layers of paper that the essence, the soul, has to go down through. That by the time it gets down, it's all homogenized out and, you know, guaranteed to satisfy the largest majority of the viewing public.
I think the only thing that
I think that's where you get network television.
I think the only series that really comes to mind other than the old Sierras is anything Will Wright does. You know, Sims,
well,
they all have the same
Will Wright gets to say so. That he's the perfect example of what I'm saying because he's kept autonomy. You know, those games are him. You know, if you know Will, that's the way he thinks. You can see the numbers churning there, those algorithms buzzing away. I mean, that's a perfect example of, you know, some place where – now, he's been successful at it, and he's been able to do it in spite of the fact that there are huge numbers of staff on that project. I mean, that's four.
Well, and it's owned by EA, so that's even.
Well, yeah, but EA's smart enough that that they kind of let him run the thing, and as opposed to, you know, big studio clarifying everything and making sure that it doesn't offend anyone.
Yeah. Now I think and this kind of comes into my next point about Sam and Max. Now that was a LucasArts product that went back to
sure.
itself.
Yep.
And Telltale is releasing them all over the internet.
Yeah,
so
episodic
there's no
content.
Production. Right.
Yeah.
Although I bought the DVD.
How are they doing with that? Do you know?
Fairly
well. Is
that
successful?
Yeah, I mean, it's so successful. In fact, like I said, I bought the retail copy a couple days ago.
Uh-huh.
And it's really, you know, it's really well put together. I know that they've renewed, you know, I guess they're going to renew the contract for season two,
good.
I guess you could say. But, yeah, I don't know how actually involved Steve Purcell is anymore because he's with Pixar.
Uh-huh.
He's doing animation for Pixar. But the people they have behind it have that same kind of humor that they did for Sam and Max Hit the Road. Back in LucasArts days.
Well, I wish them success. I'd be glad to see them succeeding so far, and I hope they continue to because that sort of humor is sorely needed in today's marketplace.
Yeah, it's
sort of,
you know, it's
laughable products these days. Well, I shouldn't say it that way. No, there's a lot of laughable products. There's not a lot of products that make me laugh. I guess.
Yeah. But, you know, the funny thing about it is, and I think they did this with Bone, too, although Bone, I know, wasn't as successful as Sam and Max have been, but they added like action sequences to the first couple because they thought, well, you know, this will bring in the adventure game fans and the fans of people who like these action sequences. But they stopped doing that, I think, around the third episode. So it was really nice to see. Now it's all point and click again.
I tried to do some action sequences in Larry 3, I think. And for the most part, they just annoyed players.
Yeah.
I mean, they weren't that big, and they weren't that long, and they weren't that difficult. But on the other hand, why bother? You know, it's like, that's not why I bought this game. I didn't buy this in order to, you know, be frustrated by this because I don't have the eye-hand coordination or whatever. And, you know, they were there for a different reason, and so I'm kind of, you know, at the point of not trying to, I wouldn't try to do that if I were going to do a new game.
Actually, yeah. You know, it's funny that a lot of the Sierra releases at the time did that. They had Conquest of the Longbow. I don't remember if you remember that one, the Robin Hood game. They had the fighting.
Yeah. And I then, mean, you got to understand that there none of us went to school. There were no courses on how to do these games.
Yeah.
We were making it up as we went along, and you know, you would hear of something that somebody did, and you go, maybe I should try that. Maybe that'll work. We didn't know what we were doing. You know, somebody wrote me and asked, did you put all those dead ends in your games on purpose to make it harder? No, I just kind of screwed up. I didn't realize that I probably should have not let you go into the next area without the equipment you needed or whatever it was, you know. But hell, we didn't know what we were doing. We were just trying to figure it out as we went along. And, you know, that was one of the things that was frustrating about my software career was that by the time I ended with Larry 7, Love for Sale, I really felt like I knew what I was doing. I mean, that was like the first game where I thought, yeah, I get this. I know what to do now. I can do this. And then they didn't let me do any more. I was like, man, you know. It's just... So anyway.
That was actually one of the things I always hated about the early games for Sierra, that was the parser. Because
we tried. I mean, one of the things that helped us was I figured out, let's see, it was Larry 1. It took me about 3 months to program, design, write all the text, put all the art together and implement the game. So about 3 months. That was about 3 months' work. So it came out, and it was March or February, I guess. And there's no real game market at that time of year. For some reason, it just kind of dies. Sierra wasn't real wild about shipping it then. And I think they may have had some other big game that they were shipping at the same time. So I said to Ken, you know, maybe we should try beta testing these things because we've never had anybody test these games. We had people that did bug testing, but all they looked for was, you know, does it blow up? Does it crash? You know, can you get through all of it? So I actually wrote a special piece of code, and we sent out this specially modified game to 12 people. And that were good adventure gamers, but had never seen the product and had no idea what to do or how to do it, and had no hint books, no anything else. They were just raw good game players. But the module that I wrote, every time it would give that horrible answer that we all hated, which was, you can't do that here, at least not now, you know, which was the ultimate sign of, damn it, I don't know what you're talking about. that was the translation of that sentence. So we every time it would present that on the screen, it would write down on floppy disk the person's location, what they were doing, and what the situation was, how many points they had, and just a whole bunch of just kind of general data. Now you got to remember, this is common practice now in games to do this kind of testing. But back then, nobody had ever done that, and so I wrote this module that was then implemented into all the Sierra games, and used thereafter. And one of the things that I wrote down was what you typed in. And so I took all this data back, and it was huge. Used the DOS sort routine, DOS sorting program, to take all these text files and sort them so that they were all in order by room. And then I went through and implemented, eliminated all the duplicates, and I went through and implemented everything that everybody had typed in. And
oh,
that's
wow.
why that game understood a lot more than most other games, was because we had actually tested, and I had the luxury of not having to ship it out the door when it was finished, but rather being able to refine it for a month or so, kind of on my own time.
I think one of the most frustrating game experience I had with the parser was in King's Quest 3, because you're supposed to turn man and Anne.
Hey,
into
wait
a
minute.
Cat.
I was the programmer on that game.
Were you? You're supposed to turn man and Anne into a cat, right?
Oh,
so you
God.
Could escape.
Yes.
But it was almost impossible to do.
Right.
And so what?
Well, it turned into a typing test.
Yeah.
Because Roberta, I remember this vividly, because she insisted that you type the spells exactly as shown. And I said, well, what if they miss a punctuation, or what if they miss a capital letter? Nope, that doesn't count. They have to do it exactly. And I was like, oh, God, Berta, that's not going to be fun. But she insisted. And so, yeah, you had to do it, and you had to do it in a certain amount of time, I think.
Right.
Yep. Yeah.
Because he would come down and find you.
Oh, man. Yeah, that was tough.
So the one thing that I learned, actually, I was playing it with my dad at the time. One thing that we found out was that if you saved and loaded enough times, you could get off the island and you could make it away from them. You could make it out and finish the game without him coming and catching you. Because that's how...
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, because it wasn't time-based or anything. It was random when he came.
Well, it was time-based. There was some timer in that, because I remember, because I had to implement the time counting up in the taskbar. But it was Sierra time. We didn't have access to the system code. We being the applications level guys, it was difficult for me to get functions out of the low-level guys. They had their code, and they wanted to keep it pristine, and every time they'd add something to it, they would add bugs, and so it was tough for us to get. So we didn't have real seconds until, much later. So what we did was we faked it based on how many times you went through the code. And we picked a number that we thought was a fair amount of numbers. Well, now with fast machines that take no time to generate, animation, back then the computers were so slow that they spent most of their time generating the limited amounts of animation that we had on the screen. Whereas now that takes, nothing, 1 millisecond. So many of the timers and stuff, have become impossible to beat these days.
But we did. We beat the game without ever having turned man into a cat.
Good
for
you.
It wasn't until I bought the box set and had access to game FAQs that I ever figured out how to do it.
So. Yeah, well, that was, you solved the puzzle, but not in the way that we extended. My worst one was... let's see, what was the one with King's Quest 1, I think, with Rumpelstiltskin, and you had to spell his name backwards, and there was no clues whatsoever that you should spell Rumpelstiltskin backwards. I was like, how the hell would anybody know that,
I think that was part of the fun of it, it was, it's the same way, and I think the way that Myst was popular is that, with Myst, they just didn't tell you what to do, and you kind of had to figure it out.
Yep.
And so much of it was so convoluted that, I think it's the same way, that's why adventure games, for the thinking public anyway, were just like, well, it's so convoluted that I've got to figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
But.
Well, we really thought that when computers were in 10% of American homes, that we would have it made as a company, because our big problem now is not enough people have computers that can play our games. We were making games that were pretty state of the art, and a lot of people's machines just wouldn't run them. So when computers got to 25% of the marketplace, it was like, oh my gosh, this is going to be fantastic. But it wasn't. What we found out was that, you know, we were doing PBS games, and you know, the public really wanted Fox.
I don't know if I'd ever call Larry PBS.
Yeah, we just the idea that you want to be sit down and be challenged to this just mind numbingly difficult things. Yeah, it wasn't really didn't really turn out to be what 99% of America wants.
Which is really sad, I think, especially now, because I played The Longest Journey and Dreamfall, and those were two of, I think, the best games I think I've played in a long time. But I don't think that many people played them because they were graphic adventure.
Yep.
But yeah, I'm glad that the company behind that, and Ragnar Tornquist, the guy who wrote them, they're going to do like episodic content, like Sam and Max did.
Well, I wish them well. I hope they succeed at it. It's a tough market today. I mean, it's the opposite of the situation I described earlier in our conversation here. Back then, you have to remember, Matt, when we did these games, there was no Photoshop.
Yeah.
I say that to people, and they look at me like, well, what do you have, like clay tablets and stone knives or something? What the hell? How could there be no Photoshop? But we had to invent a program. One of the guys at Sierra had to build a program that allowed us to draw on the screen. We had to build a program that allowed us to take two drawings and put them together in an animation, which now everybody has in a GIF editor and stuff. I mean, those things are just commonplace, and yet we had to build that from scratch. And so, therefore, the bridge to getting in, the wall to climb over to play in that marketplace was really high. And nowadays, geez, everybody's got access to Flash. You can do Flash games, pretty easy. And to a certain extent, I think that that's where the real creativity in the marketplace lies, is the online games, the casual games, the Flash games that are out there. I think that's where you see a lot of the personality and the creativity in products today. I mean, who cares if you can, in your first-person shooter, that your protagonist's ankle bends at a 15-degree angle when he's on a 15-degree ramp. I mean, that's what they're down. Well, see, what is the angle of his eyebrow when he makes that face? It's like, who cares? Why would I care about that? But obviously that's all they have to sell is, the slight differences in products.
That the marketplace is kind of moving away from that, and especially with
The Wii has certainly proved that to be a false presumption. I think that that's been a wonderful surprise. The fact that lots of people who don't buy shooters and don't buy multiplayer online games are buying Wiis and the games that they're.
Well, and even if you look now. We were just talking about this before we got you on the phone about this new game for the Xbox 360, BioShock. Now, obviously, one of their big selling points is how good it looks on HDTV. But if you ever play the game, it's story driven. It is a shooter. Yeah, they based the storyline in the game off of the works of Ayn Rand. Actually, so it's like a psychological thriller.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. A BioShock, it's called?
Yeah.
I'll have to look that up.
The other one that actually, while we're suggesting games, the other game that I suggest to anybody, if they really liked the old point-and-click adventures but wanted something a little different to it, there's a game called Indigo Prophecy, which came out a year and a half ago, I think. It was a completely story-driven game. You played it like kind of like a point-and-click adventure, but it was more action-oriented. Mm-hmm. So I think the first two-thirds of the game were really fantastic, and then I guess it seemed like they ran out of money or something, and they just sped through the last third of the game without telling much story. But
yeah, that happens. Story is expensive, particularly in 3D, you know, immersion kind of first-person environment, even in third-person environment. I mean, it's difficult to do story because story means unique interactions. Story means unique camera angles and interesting dialogue and all these things that don't do well to be programmatically represented. You know, you can blow up monsters and, you know, every one of them will blow up the same. Or you can put in 10 variations and you'll see 10 different blow-ups. But on the other hand, it's a very simple matter of, I shouldn't say very simple, none of this stuff is very simple. But, but I mean, it's easier to do that than it is to create one-time-only content for, which is what story requires. I mean, you have to have a different set of code and instructions and everything for those. And, you know, that was, I guess that goes back to one of the ways that we made products back then, which was to allow the games to be data-driven, that we could create the content and by doing a lot of text and talking and interaction and so forth that way. We didn't have to draw as many backgrounds and do as much animation and do all that kind of stuff. So we could make games that were profitable to make. So many games today start off and they have great intentions, but when the reality hits that somebody's got to sit there with a mouse and or a Wacom tablet and just go through and make all that stuff happen, that, oh my gosh, it becomes very expensive and therefore it gets cut.
Yeah. Well, one of the big examples of that is Knights of the Old Republic 2. Now, Knights of the Old Republic 1 was really, I mean, I think, for as far as RPGs go, I think it was the most story-driven one I think that I can think of, because it was kind of like, I mean, I don't want to say it was kind of like an adventure game, because it really wasn't.
But I know what you're saying. It had the conversation trees. It had the interaction between you and the characters, and you know, it felt like an adventure, yeah.
And it would change throughout the course, you know, depending on what you chose and, you know, who you chose to interact with. It would,
about which side you went with, and that immediately multiplies everything in the game times two. You know, it became a very expensive game to implement, I'm sure.
Yeah, and then Knights of the Old Republic 2 came out, and people wondered, well, you know, why wasn't it similar? But actually, they found out if you go into the source code, there was a ton more of that stuff that got cut. Uh-huh. There was a whole another 2 hours, probably about 15 hours of gameplay that just got cut because they didn't have time to implement it.
Well, and probably if that much was implemented and got cut, then you know that they needed to do that much more probably on top of it. They didn't, you know, they don't make the decision the last day after everything's done. They make it when they realize, oh my God, we've dug ourselves a hole we can never fill. Yeah, kind of like this show. you don't have an hour time slot that you have to fill, do you?
No.
We're at 63 minutes right now.
No kidding. Well, I have a TV sense of mind, I guess.
No, like I said, we just, Hawk Show is all about, I think we usually do about an hour news program, and then we just fill the rest of the time. So.
Well, I'm happy that you're filling it with me.
Yeah.
I'm happy to be your filler.
Well, usually it's just me and Dan talking. That's not nearly as interesting.
You know, I think we put Dan asleep.
Oh, no.
I haven't heard from Dan.
Yeah, anymore. I've thoroughly enjoyed this program.
Dan wasn't a big adventure gamer.
No, I didn't own a computer at the time that these were out, but I know the names and I know the games because I saw my friends playing them and heard people talking about them. But no, I unfortunately didn't have a computer when they were big.
Well, it was a great time to have a computer. I first got involved, as I said, through really outside means, but got hooked on computer games and started just playing games all the time. And the games that I enjoyed the most were the adventure games from Sierra. And isn't it ironic that I ended up working for them? and partly that's because I did games that looked like theirs. You know, the games that I created on my own, you know, they looked like I emulated Roberta. I mean, I did the kind of games that they did because that's what I liked. And then, of course, you know, that turned out to be a damn good marketing strategy for me, but it didn't really work. I mean, it wasn't intended that way. That wasn't the way it was supposed to come out. But.
Well, yeah, I guess for me it was one of those things where, you know, I didn't own a Nintendo, like the NES, until after it had become popular. And my dad was in the computer industry. He worked for Control Data back at the time.
Oh, I remember.
So that. We always had, you know, pretty top of the line computers and nothing to do with them, obviously, because back in that time there wasn't, you know, you had DOS shell or, you know, whatever, and it didn't run anything.
Yeah, part of that, part of my belief in why adventure games came and went is that they were perfectly suited for the small fraction of the population who could own a computer then. Computers were very expensive. You had to have some kind of work-related reason to buy one. You didn't go out and spend $5,000 on a system to play games. I mean, you could go get a Nintendo for a few hundred bucks to play games. So I think that the reason that, you know, things adventure games require typing. They required solving puzzles, and that's exactly what DOS was. You know, you had to type, you had to be a puzzle solver because you couldn't, I mean, you had to configure your config.sys and autoexec.bat files.
Mm-hmm.
And you were constantly changing those. You had to play with upper memory management. You had all kinds of just esoteric and bizarre things that you had to try in order to get your machine to work. Well, hell, look at adventure games. What more are they than people trying arcane and bizarre combinations and going, hey, look, that worked. You know, so I think it was the perfect game for that marketplace. And as computers became easier to use, they appealed to people who weren't such puzzle-solving maniacs, and then... you know, adventure games weren't as appealing to them either.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that's definitely, you know, I was in the situation where, you know, I was kind of the nerdy computer guy back then. And, you know, that was my thing, is I really liked, and actually, you know, I ended up becoming a writer and not a computer game. So, but, you know, part of that, the whole reason I became a writer was, you know, the fact that, especially the Sierra games and later on the LucasArts games, they really encourage that think about what's going to happen, you know, and try to get there. And I just think, I wish more stuff did that nowadays. You know, I guess and like you said, I'm probably one of the last bastion of people but you know, like just the regular first person shooters and stuff don't appeal to me because there's not any challenge to shooting people.
You know, I looked at Ultima and some of those games, and I kept thinking I was missing the point. I kept thinking, oh, there's more to it than this. You know, you just don't get it, Lo. You're missing something. And then I would talk with people, and I'd say, yeah, what? Explain this game to me. Well, you go around, you do this, you do that. Oh. Okay, well, I guess that's it then. I wasn't missing anything. There's just not something there that appeals to me. And I feel the same way about first-person shooters. You know, I think they're fine. If you like them, great, enjoy them. But if, you know, they're not my cup of tea. But that's why they make different kind of cars. That's why they publish different kinds of books. That's, you know, that's why not all movies are the same.
So are you, still playing anything these days, or...?
Games?
Yeah.
Not much, no.
Yeah?
I have to admit, there's not a lot of games. You know, part of it is that being in the business spoils you for games.
Guess.
Because, you know, for a number of years, I love playing games. And then for a number of years, I had to play games to stay current. But playing them became market research. And now that I'm out of the business, I don't need to do market research, and therefore I just tend to kind of ignore it. So I must admit that, no, I don't play a lot of games anymore. I play backgammon. I play, you know, other games, but I don't play a mean free cell. but no, as far as – and part of that is that the games changed, there wasn't that much that appealed to me.
Yeah. Well, I would suggest, though, that you did check out the Sam and Max, because I think you would really enjoy.
Well, I'm sure I will. Yeah, I'm sure that I will enjoy it, because I loved those games.
And I think, actually, the official release was this week. I bought it at Walmart, and they were
selling it. Wow. Good for them. They got into Walmart?
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah, it's... it was a pretty. I haven't seen actually much advertising for it, which I think is too bad. But
yeah, well, ads cost a lot of money.
Yeah.
Would you rather see that money on your screen, or would you rather see it, you know, going up in the air?
Well, anyway, so I should let you plug your website again.
What website?
Allo.com.
Oh, thank you. Yes.
I know.
Yeah,
I,
you know, it's funny. I'll digress just a moment about that.
Sure.
When I got out of the gaming industry and retired back in 1998, I still had a lot of jokes that I had saved up over the years. And I thought, what the heck can I do with this? So I started a joke list. And for the past 8-9 years, I have sent out 2 jokes every weekday morning. And I'm up now to, I think, 6,000 people on the list. With no advertising, no marketing, no sales, no promotion, no nothing, just word of mouth. Every day, one or two people join. And I run it through Yahoo groups, so there's no management to speak of on my part. And it's a free service, and I started off thinking, well, I'll give back to the public, you know, because they treated me well by buying my games. I'll give these back. And besides, I had 1,000 jokes sitting there. What am I going to do with them? Well, what's happened was that I ended up receiving far more than I ever sent out. I mean, I get jokes now from 6,000 people. And it's just wonderful. So the list has now sent out over 4,000 jokes over the years, all of them unique. I do my best to not ever send out duplicates, although I fail. I mean, it's a human system. I run it myself. There's no staff of thousands here doing this. It's just me. But yeah, if people want to start off their day with a smile. Tell them to go to allo.com and sign up for CyberJoke 3000.
The CyberJoke 3000.
Yep.
Huh?
And it's well worth the price they pay, which is nothing. But it's funny, about 3 or 4 years ago, I started including links in it as if I were doing a blog, I guess. Just kind of, hey, I saw this thing on the web and it was interesting and you might like it too. And I now people send me those. And so now I have like a steady running, besides the 2 jokes, which you still get every day, you also get some kind of interesting stumble upon kind of a link that will make you smile or make you think or whatever, you know, just something that I find of interest. So. Plus, the website itself is just full of stuff that made me laugh. I think my purpose with the site was not to be the world's most complete repository of humor, but rather the most judiciously edited. So you won't find badly written material. You won't find stuff that's, you know, distasteful or racist or whatever. I mean, you know, I don't do any of the, you know, really sick porn or any kind of stuff like that. But there's stuff that's been through my editing process. So if you liked my games and if you like my sense of humor, there's a ton of it there on the website for free, and all you got to do is click to get there. There's no charges,
is actually,
there's no anything. So
one of the things I really liked about Leisure Suit Larry, now I didn't get to play it until later in life, obviously, but you know,
why
it was
that?
Oh, well, because my parents actually paid attention to what I was playing when I was younger.
Well, that's a mistake.
Yeah.
Look at how you've turned out.
But, no, I just think that, you know, it's so funny that, you know, especially nowadays, people say, oh, look at, you know, sexual content and the hot coffee thing, for example, which I didn't think was that big a deal myself. But,
no.
You know, it was just one of those things where, you know, there was Larry was raunchy, but it wasn't ever overtly sexual.
Well, it was never pornographic.
Right.
You know, I tried to be sexual in a way, but I tried to be funny about it. I tried to to use it as the wedge to get people, you know, into the gaming part of it and into the that. So there was while there was a little sex there, there was never as much as was promised on the packaging. You know, the Sierra guys and I always went through a real hassle when they would, you know, they'd create the box and it was like, oh my God, what's in here? You know, and then you'd open it up and it would be a comedy. And it was like, well, wait, maybe you should back off. You know, it's not like, it's not that strong. But anyway, I mean, we always had that mixture. But I always had a wife who would snap me back when I crossed over the line. You know, and when I would have some idea, I'd run it by her, and she'd say, "Nah, you don't want to. Nah, don't do that." And I'd say, "Okay, I guess not." You know, so I think a great part of the game's success goes to Margaret because she helped me realize where the limits of good taste are.
Yeah. So, like I said, Allo.com. You got a bunch of other stuff on there. I don't want to just stop it at the CyberJoke 3000 or anything. You got your music from Leisure Suit Larry up there.
Oh, and tried to put up a lot of inside stories. If you've listened this long to this conversation, then you should probably go check out the inside stories up there about Sierra, because I've got a bunch of things about, you know, stuff that happened during the early years of the company. I've got information there about the games I worked on. And just, well, like there's one page that's the list of 32 or so rejected titles for the game Love for Sale.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I tried to come up with a title for the game, and so I just started brainstorming, and I wrote down all these different weird puns on sailing and cruises and sex and stuff, and so there's like a list of 32 rejected titles for Leisure Suit Larry Love for Sale, and one of them was Yank Hers Away was one I remember, and Leisure Suit Larry Fills His Dinghy with Semen was one I rejected. So, you know, SEA, you know. But it was, you know, there's a lot of those things up there. So, and just weird little stuff about how we created the games and fun stuff.
I haven't checked it out maybe as fully as I should have, but yeah, I mean, I found a lot of stuff that's really cool up there.
There's a lot of, I have a SiteGeek browser that, I don't know, there are places on the web, sites that have sight gags, you know, funny photographs and things. Mm-hmm. But here again, what I do is edit. You know, I've got about 1,000 of the funniest ones, and then I sometimes I add captions to them and that, but mostly they stand alone. But I don't have 10,000 where you have to go through 9,000 stupid ones. You know, that's the service that I provide, is that I eliminate all the really stupid stuff and put up the things that I think are funny.
All right, well, you are a real character, Al, and I I thank you for everything that you did for me as I was growing up, from Black Cauldron to Leisure Suit Larry 7, Love for Sale. It was a very big part of my development. So I don't know if you should be proud about that or not.
Well, I mean, you know, look at where you are today.
Yeah. Hosting a podcast.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yep, it's great. Well, I'm glad that you found enjoyment in my humble little offerings, because God knows I never realized when we created those games that how popular they would become, nor that people would be interested in them in 2 years, let alone 20 years. I mean,
yeah,
Black Cauldron came out 25 years ago, and
wow.
I never had a dream that anybody would still talk about that in after a year or two. They were short-term products that we were putting out like a magazine. You know, it's like a magazine mm-hmm. where you in a week there's going to be another one, and for people still be interested in them at this point is marvelous to me, and I'm just real happy that I could make people laugh, because I enjoyed playing other people's games, and I try to make games that I would enjoy playing, and in doing so, you know, we made people laugh, and gosh, what's wrong with that?
There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah. Yep.
So, thank you very much.
Pleasure talking with you.
Yeah, and check out allo.com for more Al, and sign up for the CyberJoke 3000. I've been a member now for 2 months, and I really enjoyed getting a little dose of humor in my email inbox every day.
Well, good.
So,
thanks.
Yep.
Thank
you.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Bye. That was Al Lowe, everybody, from Leisure Suit Larry and Sierra in their heyday. And that is the end of this episode of The Hawk Show. Thank you all for listening, and we'll be back next week with more news and stuff. Dan, thank you for joining us also.
All right. Thank
even
you.
Even though you didn't
Bye.
Say anything. Bye.